This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
What are the most memorable travel adventures? Those where we open our eyes and our minds to new experiences. It's all to see here in Azerbaijan. New flavours, a new appreciation of ancient history, of natural beauty and of rich contrasts. This is a world of culture, cuisine, wellness and adventure, all yours for the taking. Thought you knew Azerbaijan? Take another look. To plan your Azerbaijan adventure, visit azerbaijan.travel.
Across Northern Ireland, on your radio and on BBC Sounds. This is
The Stephen Nolan Show!
Hello, it's Holly here once again for Stephen. And yesterday, I know we were talking about waiting times for cancer treatment. Well, today, it's the subject was all about getting mental health services, in any capacity, in fact. And this was following the trial of Gary Baird, who was sentenced yesterday for killing his wife Susan in Belfast 4 years ago. Now, he had been found guilty of manslaughter by diminished responsibility. And it was during the trial that we heard that Mr. Baird had tried to ring his GP 570 times to get help with his mental health. Not one call was answered. His family are now calling for more funding into mental health services here in Northern Ireland. And we want to know your experience. You know, have you struggled to access help? Have you been put off even trying to get help because of those long waiting lists? A lot of you getting in touch on that today. We also, of course, had to talk about football, the Euros. England are somehow into the final after that win over the Netherlands last night. Despite most of the coverage throughout this tournament just being about how poor their performances have been. There's been so much criticism of the manager, Gareth Southgate. Here we are, how the tables have turned. So we have been taking a look at how they have progressed throughout this tournament and trying to predict what exactly is going to happen in that final against Spain on Sunday. We were also having a chat around age limits on senior political figures. This is after George Clooney urged his friend Joe Biden to withdraw from the presidential campaign in the USA because of his recent appearances. As Clooney says, for the good of the country. You've been having your say on that as well, as always. And do continue to get in touch. In the meantime, it's nolan at bbc.co.uk. And I'll be right back here tomorrow at 9 o'clock. I'll see you then.
The Stephen Nolan Show!
We're taking a look at access to mental health services here in Northern Ireland. Now, you will have seen the headlines this week. The spotlight very much on the issue after 65-year-old Gary Baird was sentenced for killing his wife, Susan, with a hammer at their home in Belfast 4 years ago. Now, he had been found guilty of manslaughter by way of diminished responsibility. He was sentenced to 7 years, three in custody, and it does mean that with time already served, he will be released later this year. And during the trial, we heard that Mr. Baird had tried to ring his GP 570 times with his own concerns about his mental health. Not one was answered. Speaking after the sentence was imposed, the couple's children did issue a statement. They said, "As the four children of Susan Baird, we welcome and accept the verdict. Through our immense heartbreak, we hope to see improvements and better funding in mental health services across Northern Ireland." Now, in response to this case, the Health Minister, Mike Nesbitt, told our health correspondent, Mary-Louise Connolly, that we need to do more for mental health provision here.
There's a need, I think, to look at the lack of access by telephone to GP surgeries, because I think, along with the other 89 MLAs, I'm aware of multiple examples of people who are struggling to get through. There's also the question of confirming whether we are doing enough in terms of mental health. And I've been campaigning on that since I was elected in 2011. And I don't think we'll ever be able to do enough. So we're always going to be trying to do more. It's an issue actually I raised with the new Health Secretary in London and with the Prime Minister when he was here on Monday. Our rates of mental health, per mental health are shocking compared to the rest of the UK.
And it's not the first case, actually, that we've seen like this one in recent years. In 2017, Michael and Marjorie Caudery were killed in their Portadown home by Thomas McEntee, who had also unsuccessfully tried to seek help for his mental health. Their son-in-law, Charles Little, joins me here this morning. Good morning, Charles.
Good morning.
Charles, thank you for coming back on. We have spoken in the past, and I'm sure you have been following this case of the Bairds. Has that been quite difficult for you?
Yes, it has. And first of all, I'd just like to send my family's condolences to the Baird family. Situation like this, you know, it just tears you apart, and our thoughts are very much with them. For us, it does bring it all back. And brings it because these things never go away. And it's this aspect of seeking help and not receiving it. It really is a problem that the health service has yet to get its mind round and yet to get a grip on. And I mean, if you think also the case of James Hughes back in 2016, James Devine, who killed James Hughes, he had been contacting the Belfast Trust looking for help. And all he'd got was an appointment 2 weeks later, but that was too late. The people just not got their mind around it.
And like I said, we've talked about this in the past, and there is a sense certainly that lessons just aren't being learned.
That's absolutely right. If you look at the mental health strategy, it says in it, most fundamental of all, we must prevent the avoidable deaths. Now that, if that is the most fundamental of all, that's the metric by which the mental health strategy's success or failure must be measured. And the rest of the strategy doesn't really refer to that again. And that is the problem that's coming out. At the moment, they are looking at redesigning the SAI process. And in some of the documentation, I'll read you a little sentence because it shows the attitude the health service has towards these sorts of incidents. It says, in those infrequent and often highly complex incidents involving a serious crime, for example, in the case of a homicide, compassionate and engagement with victims of the crime and their families is an important aspect. But it's that infrequent, it's not infrequent. In Northern Ireland, we average 3 mental health homicides a year, every year, year on year. That's 1 every 4 months on average. And not all of these attacks result in deaths. There are people who survive. So it's a much bigger problem than they think, and it most certainly isn't infrequent. But it's also the phrase they use there with the engagement with victims of the crime, as if they are somehow, the health service is somehow distanced from it. Now, in our case, the coroner found that the deaths were entirely preventable. If they were entirely preventable, what that means is the health service, and in our case also the police, did not prevent a crime. They are complicit. And it's this attitude of, it was a mental health problem. This is where mental health stigma starts, with the health service. And they've got to get a grip of this.
That's interesting because, yes, they seem to have made a leap there. There's almost like a bit missing in the middle, the bit where you actually tackle the problem.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's this disassociation in their heads. There is this, they have a mental block, in my view, culturally, that only a patient can be harmed. And it's getting their mind around the fact that they actually have victims of their actions or omissions, and they have to think of them in that light, and they don't do that.
And it's interesting because there have been inquests into this, certainly into the case of your mother and father-in-law, where they made it very clear that the killer in this instance was also a victim because he was failed by mental health services.
Absolutely. And I would suggest that this will be the case with the Baird family as well. I mean, he had been in hospital only a week before, having jumped in front of a bin truck, which clearly was a cry for help. And he was then released from hospital.
Yeah, and in that instance, there were sort of incidents that he had
acted
in certain ways. Obviously, we don't know for fact whether or not he had tried to take his own life in that instance. But he certainly had made attempts to, and we do know because of call logs that he made more than 470 calls to his GP. And you do wonder, at what point does anybody listen?
Exactly. At what point does anybody listen? And as I say, there's an average of three mental health homicides every year in Northern Ireland. In the last 4 years across the UK as a whole, there was over 230. It's a massive problem, and it needs to be addressed. And the only way you're going to address it properly is by learning from the incidents that have happened before. Now, in 1995... you probably don't recall, but a young boy called Kieran Hegarty was killed by a mental health patient near Strabane. Mm-hmm. And the Serious Adverse Incident Review into that recommended that there should be a specific outreach team set up to manage the patients who are most likely to harm themselves or others. That was ignored. In 2016, the National Confidential Inquiry into Suicide and Homicide said it was crucial to maintain contact with outreach teams, with the people who fall into what's known as a sort of chaotic category, which are the people who are really in a difficult state, to make sure that they're getting the care they need. That was ignored. In 2022, the London Victim Research Unit said that losing contact withdrawing from contact with the health service is a sign that there may be trouble to come, and the health services need to get a grip of that. That again, that's been ignored. The problem here is if a patient loses contact, if they don't respond or they don't turn up for appointments or they don't respond to letters, they get struck off, they're discharged. But these are the people who are probably the ones most in need of help. And they need to get a grip. This is their own research that's been paid for. This is their own SAI reports saying that contact must be maintained, and they don't do it.
You know, Charles, when you start to look into this issue with mental health problems in Northern Ireland, and I know you have in depth, and the scale of the problem, it's actually quite difficult to find a measuring stick, actually, because there are so many figures and timescales and strategies and reports. And then when we have a case like Mr. Baird and with your mother and father-in-law, and it comes to the forefront, and we're here talking about it now. But what happens in a couple of months' time? Do you think that's just a pattern now that we've become used to?
It comes down to that when these incidents happen, the health service should be carrying out its serious adverse incident reviews, and it should, which the purpose of which is to learn what went wrong. And then to put a change in place to make sure wherever possible it can't happen again. They don't do that. They hold a serious adverse incident reviews and then nothing happens. The report is duly filed. And deaths occur again with the same errors because they haven't learned. There was a paper used by Queen's University, one of their students, two or three years ago, looking at mental health suicide in Northern Ireland. And they identified that the same recommendations are made over and over again in every serious adverse incident review. Obviously, if the same recommendations are being made, they're not being implemented.
Yeah.
Exactly. And the other thing that completely fails in the SAI process is there is no verification in the process of what has actually been done. The report is written, it's sent out to people, then there is no follow-up verification to make sure that the changes have been put in place, that the staff have been trained, and the staff understand what they're doing. That never happens.
And you do get a sense of that when you do read any sort of reports and strategies and articles. It's always the same language, and it's always that we're in a crisis. And I mean, some of these date back to 2017, and yet nothing's changed. Charles, are you in conversation with anyone about this within government or elsewhere?
I am through the Patient Client Council. I'm in part of an engagement panel with what is called the Redesign Development Group, who are trying, who are now rewriting the SAI process. And I have to say, I'm not happy with the way they're doing it.
Oh, really?
The word independent does not appear anywhere in any of their documents. So there's no going to be no independence, it would appear, in how the SAIs are carried out. They're not going to be robust investigations, it would appear. And so that needs to be addressed. And I would say the Minister of Health really needs to step in and look at what's going on there. I'm also, after our inquest, the Justice Department and the Health Department have set up a joint task and finish group to follow up all the recommendations from our inquest. But you have to look at that. That's 7 years after the incident. It's taken 7 years to set that up. Very few of the recommendations from their SAIs have actually been, their serious adverse incident reviews, have actually been implemented. They're only starting to do it now. And it's a long-winded process. The police, on the other hand, have they're looking at introducing the right care, right person principle, which is that when you have a mental health incident, the right person is tasked to go and provide the right care, because quite often the police are just tasked to an incident and they're not the right people to go to it, etc. Now, right care, right person has been introduced poorly in some police forces and health services in England. They've handled it badly. I'm part of the police reference group for this, and I'm adamant that they have to work hand in hand with the health service to introduce this. The principle is absolutely sound. I mean, if it'd been used in our case, if the right person provided the right care on the Monday of that week, it would have involved a couple of police officers and one hospital, and that would have got the problem solved. As it was, over the week, there were 25 police officers and three hospitals and three health trusts involved over the 5 days, and they still got it wrong. So there's a clear need to improve there, and right care, right person may well be, if it's done properly and handled properly, the way forward on that. But even then, it depends on 999 calls. In my family's case, there were no 999 calls. The Baird case, there were no 999 calls. They were trying to phone the GP surgery. In the case of the death of James Hughes, the perpetrator of the crime was trying to phone the Belfast Trust. So there's got to be this system that can collect together all of the contacts from mental health people in crisis or from their families and focus them to the place that can send the right care out. System doesn't exist at the moment.
You're in a position where you can give us this insight into what attempts are being made to try to address this issue. And it does feel like in some way that they do have the answers. I mean, you're literally talking about it right now, and we have, you know, the mental health strategy, and there are things that can be implemented. So what's the hold up then? And how long are they planning to wait before these are put into action? And have they given you a sense of why? You know, is it just down to money?
It's not just down to money. Money is obviously a major factor. But the real problem is the way that the health service is structured. It has a system of passive management. And by that, I mean they write letters to each other, and the writing of the letter is the completion of the action. There is no verification or follow-up to see what actually happened. It's in my intray. I've written a letter. Tick. That's done. And that's no way to manage anything. And they've got to really get a grip and accept that in these sorts of cases where people are and they're not just dying, they're being killed, that they have some responsibility in this to make sure that they are providing everything possible to try and prevent these incidents happening. And they are not doing that. And that's the fundamental problem. On the funding side, of course, we've heard all the hoo-ha over the budget, over the health service saying they haven't got enough, and the Justice Department's budget being cut as because of the amount the health service getting, etc. That's not accepting the reality of the police are a fundamental part of the mental health service. Effectively, they are the front line, and whenever the police are called out to a mental health crisis, it's the Department of Justice who's having to pay for that mental health assistance. When someone is convicted, and 30% of the people who are jailed in Northern Ireland, who are sentenced to prison, at the time of sentencing are mental health patients.
Yeah.
When they go to prison, their mental health care is paid for by the Justice Department.
They're costing themselves more, really, in the long run by not dealing with the issue.
The funding of mental health needs to be looked at in the round, not just, oh, it's a Department of Health thing. It isn't.
Charles, do you have concerns, and are you fearful that something like within the Baird family and what happened within your own family, can you foresee that happening again?
Absolutely. At the moment, and the coroner herself said in December that she was not convinced it couldn't happen again tomorrow. And that's absolutely the case. And at the moment, it will. It will until they start getting a serious adverse incident process in place that will actually independently look at each of these cases and find out what went wrong and learn and implement the learning and then verify it's been implemented. Until they can do that. And that needs to be done independently, because otherwise it's like the post office investigating itself.
Mm-hmm.
This is what the new SAI process is going to do. They're going to push it down to the trusts so that the trusts are marking their own homework. It's got to be independent. It's got to learn the lessons. It's got to implement the lessons, and it's got to verify they've been implemented. That's the real nub of this. And they've got to have a system, if they're bringing in right care, right person, they've got to have a system that will pick up all the cries for help and feed them in to make sure the right care gets out there.
Charles Little, thank you so much for talking to us this morning. Like I say, someone who can give us more insight than we could hope for. And I should mention that we have once again asked all the political parties to make comment or come on to the programme this morning to discuss the mental health issue here in Northern Ireland. And no one, once again, similar to yesterday when we talked about waiting times for cancer treatment, no one was available. Get in touch this morning, please. 03030 80 55 55. I'd like to speak to Professor Deirdre Heenan, who is a Professor of Social Policy at Ulster University. Good morning to you again.
Good morning, Holly.
Oh, I said it to Charles a moment ago. Once you start to sort of dig around a little bit into, you know, what's been done in the past, what strategies are in place, the facts, the figures, just how bad it is. I mean, it's actually quite hard to measure the issue.
It is, and sometimes I think we can feel overwhelmed. Probably listeners feel overwhelmed because it's a crisis in social care, a crisis in cancer care, GP waiting lists, you know, the list goes on. But listening to Charles speaking so eloquently and so powerfully about his own experience and his ongoing frustrations, that what he can see is lessons have not been learned. And this is a repeating pattern in terms of policy making in Northern Ireland. Firstly, we don't seem able to produce timely policy. So reviews and implementation of policy need to be talking about a decade, which really is just not acceptable. And if you look to other regions, that might be a period of 4 years, 3 years. But here, you know, we had the review of social care in 2015. We still have a draft response to that. I mean, that is simply not good enough. How can we expect to learn the lessons, to understand what needs to happen? We talk about evidence-based policymaking, and yet Charles has given us a case in point there of having evidence understanding the failings within the system, and yet somehow being unable to change policy in a timely fashion to say, we can now ensure that this will never happen again. But mental health is, you know, it's an all-encompassing issue. And Charles again talked about the mental health strategy. We have a mental health strategy, mm-hmm. but it isn't been fully implemented because we are told that we don't have the money. So we can't be sure that people with poor mental health are getting the treatments and interventions at an appropriate time. But I think the point that he raised that is really important is that the mental health strategy, even if it were fully implemented, doesn't sit in splendid isolation. It has to be linked to broader issues such as inequality, discrimination, poor housing, deprivation, mm-hmm. educational underachievement. And that's why we've been saying for the last 6 months, we desperately need to see a programme for government, because that will show us where are the cross-cutting issues, how are the police involved in mental health issues, how do we understand that issues such as mental health in prisons is extremely important and sits outside the health service. And that's why people have been continually calling for this programme for government to say, how can we see what the priorities are and how we're going to measure success?
Deirdre, do you get a sense that they don't really know, that they're grappling about a little bit with this strategy? Now, I've had a look through it. It's, you know, it's extensive. And Charles made a really interesting point that the kind of the metric that must be, which has to be met, is what they say themselves, to prevent the avoidable deaths. We know that that's not happening, but we're talking about just two incidents here this morning. And then, you know, that there's this almost bit missing. There's a bit missing of how to actually to deal with that. They're already kind of skipping ahead to how to deal with the aftermath, to deal with the victims of this.
Well, yeah, I think people are frustrated because, yes, we want to look at the metrics. And there's a lot of rhetoric. Of course, there's a lot of rhetoric and policy. But I've just finished a book on mental health. And what really struck me is when you speak to people, the key thing that they will say is, if something is physically wrong with me, I will either go to the GP or I will turn up at A&E and I will expect to get treated. With mental health, people are not sure how to access a system that they feel is very unresponsive. So if you thought you were having mental health issues or one of your children was having mental health issues, do you talk to the GP? Do you go to the voluntary sector? Do you contact your social worker? Do you know who your social worker is? Is there a community mental health team working in your area? Is there a community mental health nurse? Do you have to go through the GP to get access to these services? Mm-hmm. Or can you just self-refer, turn up and say, I think I need help? People are very unsure. And I think the first thing that would really help people who are struggling, and people should know in any case, is if you want to access services, here's a three-step process to say, this is how you do it. And if we don't get back to you today, then we will get back to you quickly. We've heard this conversation and the tragedy of the Baird family and making calls to the GP, but we don't know if those calls actually went through. We don't know if those calls were ever answered. So in many ways, we don't actually, those calls and that number doesn't really tell us very much. But if we had a process where we said, once you make contact with X, within a number of days, hours, depending on what is happening, you will have a response. People would understand how to access the system. We know that mental health is stigmatised and that people are reluctant to go forward and say, I think I might have an issue. Mm-hmm. But we also know, and Charles has made this very clear, that early intervention and prevention, these are the keys in terms of policy. It's recognising that there's an issue early, before we come to crisis point, and then knowing what you can do about it and expecting that you will get a response that is satisfactory.
Well, it's interesting. You talked about how people access it, and that is, I'm certainly getting a sense from people getting in touch this morning. Good morning to Patrick, who says people with mental health issues have to go to A&E instead of going to, you know, a mental health hospital, for example, or perhaps their GP, which doesn't seem right. It doesn't seem like you're going to accident mm-hmm. and emergency for mental health problems, but that's where people feel that they have to go. I want to continue this conversation, Deirdre, and straight after the news we'll be speaking to the Chair of the GP Committee of the BMA, Dr. Francis O'Hagan. Keep your texts coming in on this and your calls, 03030 8055 55. On the line, we have Chair of the GP Committee of the BMA, Dr. Francis O'Hagan. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Holly.
And I know you've been listening to this so far, and, you know, It's not new. It's not a new conversation that we're having. We've been having it for many years now. We have reports, we have strategies, we have a lot of facts and figures. But has anything changed? Has anything improved?
I'd like to thank you for your contribution from Charles. I think he speaks a lot of sense, and what he has said is very true. Deirdre's comments also are very relevant. Both GP services and mental health services and GP's interaction with mental health services, these are two services that have been defunded over the years and have not had the resources attached to them that they need. And hence the services then become more and more difficult to get, the appropriate contacts when patients need them. You talked about the 570 contacts with the GP service. That's 570 times attempting to ring. You know, that's not getting through. But there are, there are many people who do get through. And when they get through with a mental health problem, then our job is to try and resolve the problem if we can. But if not, then contact the mental health services. And that can be very difficult. And both the cases that we're talking about, both Charles's case of his parents and the Bird case, were already involved with mental health services. But it's the problem of access and getting the right access at the right time, as Deirdre says. And it's really, really important that we look to say, look, there needs to be a programme put in place, a strategy put in place, that we can get patients who have got problems access very quickly. And, you know, we've looked
And we don't have that. There's no speed at all at the minute for people who want help.
We don't, exactly. And that's the problem. And if we look at, you know, one of the big programmes that was introduced several years ago was the MDT programme, where that was putting a mental health worker in every GP practice. That has only, we've 17 federations in Northern Ireland, and there's only two of the federations who have actually been able to roll that programme out. What a difference that would make if we were able to get that in every GP practice, so that GPs would have access very quickly to be able to refer their patients who phoned in on the day and be able to say to you, I can get you access to a mental health practitioner today.
It feels like we are far from that at the minute. I mean, I know you're saying that he didn't get through in those calls, but 570 calls begging for help.
Well,
he knew he had a problem.
570 times hit and redial. That's not 570 calls. That's 570 times hit and redial. And no, you can hit redial up to 70
times. That is a desperate, desperate man.
Absolutely. And, you know, that is something, as a desperate man, he was already in contact with mental health services. And, you know, if he had have got through to his GP, the GP then would have been struggling to try and get him to recontact mental health services again. Because, again, the mental health programme is underfunded, just like we are underfunded. We don't have enough people in general practice, either general practitioners or other practitioners like mental health practitioners in our surgeries to help us deal with these patients and deal with, you know, all the other patients that are coming through our doors. And, you know, the MDT programme is an excellent programme, and we really need to be rolling that out, getting that out into every GP practice so that we have mental health practitioners available for our patients who so desperately need that service.
And haven't we been saying this for a while? It just feels like we're being, with the mental health strategy, again, I've looked at it. And interestingly, Paddy in Belfast has texted in to say he has a friend who's had mental health issues for years. I've been trying for 2 years to get his doctor to help him. Nothing. I wrote letters to the doctor, and then she phoned, then nothing happened. Wrote to the Minister of Health, then the champion for mental health. They never replied to me. Nothing was done. And according to this individual, that he was roaming the streets at night, and then the police had to put him in a cell. Now, obviously, we can't confirm any of this, but this is someone texting in to say that this is a desperate situation and they're begging for help. They're trying every avenue and getting nowhere.
Yes, and you've got to remember, you know, by definition, we are general practitioners. We are not specialists in any particular area. We are general practitioners. So we will see patients and we will do what we can to help them. But once we need to refer them into another service, be that any service, including mental health, we then are at the mercy of waiting on the long waiting list that patients are waiting on to be seen by any other specialty. So we need that help to come to us. And the minister, one of his priorities is mental health, and the other of his priorities is to bring services close to the community. I totally agree with him. We need to bring services like mental health closer to the community, bring them into general practice where they can be accessed in a very timely manner, so that patients, when they see us and we believe they need help over and above what we can give, that they're not languishing on waiting lists for such a long time because mental health services are not, you know, funded to provide the services. Hence, they have these huge waiting lists.
Professor Deirdre Heenan, I mean, again, I have the 10-year mental health strategy here, and this has all been recognised, and this is from what, back in 21, so 3 years on, and we're still talking about targets being missed. And this, again, to repeat, 2021, almost 2,000 people waiting more than 9 weeks for access to adult mental health services. When we're talking about thousands of people, and Dr. O'Hagan referred to it there, these waiting lists, they're getting longer and longer and longer. So it feels like the strategies that we have they're almost out of date at this point. And can that be turned around?
Well, I think it can. And I suppose I was very interested in West Reading's very quickly out of the blocks to say, before we decide what we're going to do, we're going to get an independent, very quick review to say what the problem is. And I thought, I wonder, could we do something similar here? Yes, we've had strategies and reviews, mm-hmm. but we know we don't have a joined up system. We know we can put out all sorts of shiny policy documents, but they never seem to be implemented. So what's the problem? Is there no accountability? Where is the scrutiny within the system? And that, to me, is the end game here. Where is the scrutiny? If I come along to you and say I'm going to do wonderful things and here's my target, and at the end of the year I say, oh no, I didn't achieve any of those. You say, oh, well done, keep going. And very soon you raise your eyebrow and say, I don't think this is working. It is also important to say that the proportion of the health budget, and that's, we have a devolved health budget, mm-hmm. as you know, is around 6%. That's what we spend on mental health services. In England, it's 12%. So they spend double what we do in terms of mental health services, yet we have 25% higher levels of mental illness. So we have a legacy here of low investment, and that has led to underfunded psychological and mental health services, and then inevitably long waiting times. And Francis says quite rightly, GPs are the gatekeepers to the service, but they don't have to be. We have multidisciplinary teams with mental health professionals. We were told that they would be 100% rolled out across Northern Ireland. We're currently sitting at 30%, and we are told we don't have the money to roll it out. And we invariably come back to this conversation about money. But what we don't talk about is the cost of not doing it. The cost
something Charles mentioned
earlier. Families. Exactly. The cost to productivity, the cost to the economy, the cost of intervening late, the cost of family tragedies. And we have to start thinking about the cost of not doing things as opposed to the cost of doing things, and really focus on prevention and helping people at the earliest stage possible and ensuring for them it's as easy as it possibly can be to access those services and remove the stigma. Encourage people to come along and talk about their mental health and have those talking therapies located within community.
You get a sense, Dr. Francis O'Hagan, that has changed. People are ready to talk. People are now at a point where they are desperate to talk, particularly when it comes to family and friends. Again, people getting in touch, you know, telling us awful things where they've lost children to suicide. And one text coming in here, they say that it's from an anonymous text, mental health service not fit for purpose. Do we get a sense of actually how bad the problem is? And I touched on this earlier. I'm trying to get to the bottom of the facts and figures that we have, and there are so many, and the numbers are just into the thousands. Do we have a figure, an idea of how many people right now in Northern Ireland are waiting for help for their mental health?
The figures are massive. And I mean, I want to echo what Deirdre has said. Deirdre has rightly pointed out that if you're in England, if you talk about the percentage funding, England funds their mental health services to twice the level of what is funded here in Northern Ireland. Also in England, GP services are funded to twice the level they're funded here in Northern Ireland, around 11%, and in Northern Ireland we're funded to 5.4%. Wes Streeting come out 2 days ago and said that he wants to actually increase the funding to general practice in England because he recognises mm-hmm. that we are the gatekeepers. We are the people who can recognise problems early and pick things up and get people to the right services. So if that is the case, why are we not doing this in Northern Ireland? Why are we not getting to the people who are able to pick things up early, increase our funding so that we don't have people touching their phone 570 times to try and get through, so that we can get people seen, we can get the phone answered to those people, we can put enough receptionists, we can fund enough receptionists, we can fund enough GPs, and we can fund enough other practitioners in our surgeries, rather than having to go to secondary care. This is absolutely fundamental that we change what we're doing with the money that we have. There's a lot of money being spent in Northern Ireland, more money per head of population on health than there is in England. But yet our percentages of where we're funding it is all wrong. And we need to change that. And it's been recognised in England, and it's time we recognise that here and change where we spend the money so that we can get people to the right people quickly, and we can get people seen quickly by, you know, the correct practitioners, as opposed to going on to endless waiting lists, which is so frustrating for us as GPs, and it's so frustrating for the patients who are waiting and waiting and waiting.
And the people who are so put off by these waiting lists too, Deirdre, the idea that people, and I'm sure you get a sense of this talking to people, that they wouldn't even consider going to their GP because they think, well, what's the point? I'm not going to get seen, you know, within the next year or so. And in some instances, they'll just go private, but that's not an option for the majority of people.
No, it's not an option for the majority of people, and actually it's largely not an option in this policy area anyway. You may be able to go private in terms of your hips and your knees, but there is very little by the way of private sector funding for some of these services, psychological services. Mm-hmm. And again, it depends what you're looking for, and people wouldn't be quite sure, should I see a psychologist, a psychiatrist? Who is it that I should see? What exactly is it that I need help with? It's also interesting to me that during COVID, when people couldn't see their GPs, we had some very interesting learning that, for example, young males who are having problems with their mental health actually really liked the online service and were much more willing to go online to speak to chatbots, mm-hmm. not to have to have that personal interaction with people. And they find that a satisfactory service. So what we know is what works for one group of people may not work for another group of people. So why haven't we introduced that and said, if this is the way you want to go and you don't want to be in a waiting list and you're happy to do this, then perhaps we should think about rolling that out across the piece as well. Because we know that young males have particular issues around their mental health. They're associated with high levels of suicide, and a lot of that may be about getting someone to talk to at the right time. So a lot of this is again about incorporating learning, not saying you have to go to the GP because it's the way we always did it and yeah. this is the way we must do it. We have to try to say, what is it that people actually want? We did some research in schools about mental health in schools, and students saying, you know, physical health is on the national curriculum. You remember that PE from school where mm-hmm. you had to run around the school whether you liked it or not? But mental health is not on the national curriculum. So people don't have the opportunity to realise how to manage their own mental health, how to understand when they're becoming overwhelmed. So these methods of self-regulation aren't being taught in schools, and there's still this idea of whatever you say, say nothing. And again, I think that goes back to my point about this being a cross-cutting issue. What are we doing in schools? And to be honest, what we found from our research is some of what is happening in schools is actually counterintuitive. So some schools are doing nothing, some schools are doing very good work, and some schools are doing things that actually, in our opinion, they shouldn't be doing. So again, we need to look at early intervention, prevention, and teach children how to talk about their mental health and how to understand that, for example, some anxiety is normal.
Yeah,
and some issues are normal, and stop over-medicating things that are the normal parts of a journey of life.
And that's it. And then as adults, it's something that people do struggle with, which is why so many people do find it hard to admit that they have a problem, which is why this problem, it exacerbates it, because people almost need to be taken by the hand to get the help in the first place. So when they finally get to a position where they're ready to ask for that help, and then they go up against a wall, I mean, it is a recipe for disaster. I want to take some calls on this now. Good morning, Wayne.
Good morning, Holly.
Well, Wayne, it's a frustrating situation, isn't it?
It's actually terrible, but I honestly think the snowballs got that big with overall our facilities, including mental health, the waiting times and breast cancer. But the thing I find is we have 95 million MLAs and you couldn't find one of them, none of them's available. But this problem has been going on these years, and we have all the reports and we have all the pieces of paper and they say we need money. But my basic question is, this only lies on somebody's doorstep and it's nothing to do with nurses, doctors, any of that. This relies on Stormont's doorstep. Because they had two agendas in the last 10 years, which was before anybody. And let's face it, we have people dying because they can't get lists, they can't get their treatment, they can't get anything else. One was an Irish Language Act, which took them out for 3.5 years. The other one was an RHA scandal, and the other one was Brexit. In 10 years, we had, out of them 10 years, 5 years, we had no government. People have to accept that's why we have no money getting into our health service to protect our communities on either side in 5 years.
Do you think the priorities are wrong?
And you were looking for, their priorities are completely wrong. They don't make decisions. Their agenda is completely wrong. It's one-way traffic. One wants to unite Ireland and the other wants to stay in the Union. Well, I'm sorry to disappoint you folks. We have people dying and it doesn't matter what side of the community they're from. And people got to wake up and understand the message, which is more important. Your loved ones are this nonsense these people are trying to sell.
Wayne, thank you very much for your call this morning. Just before I let you go, Dr. Frances O'Hagan, I think just a bit of advice for people. If someone is listening right now and they are struggling with their mental health, what are they supposed to do? Because I think a lot of people are in a position where they're quite simply Googling this. What is the correct path? What's the advice?
The advice is to contact your GP. And yes, I know.
You know what I'm going to say.
But yesterday I was in surgery and we had a gentleman who contacted us late in the afternoon, had never contacted us before, and just on what he had said, we picked up, at that stage we were saying we were urgent only, we picked up, we actually need to talk to this man. I spent half an hour talking to him and realised that he was in serious crisis. And then I contacted the local mental health services who did take him on. And, you know, that was somebody that, if we hadn't have picked him up, I would be seriously concerned what might have happened. So, yes, you know, it is difficult to get through, but we are there and we are seeing, you know, so many people. We're seeing 200,000 people a week. So we are seeing people. So if you are in crisis and if you are in difficulty, yes, it might be difficult to get through this first thing in the morning. But remember, if somebody is in crisis, doesn't matter what time of day you ring us at, we will respond.
That, I think, is really important for a lot of people to hear this morning, because people who are struggling, like I mentioned earlier on, it's not an easy thing to admit. And when you reach out to your GP, I think it's really important to make that clear. And I just hope, like the instance that you've mentioned there, that the GP will pick up on it and you'll get the treatment that you so desperately need. And it is so important. Thank you so much, Dr. Frances O'Hagan, and to Professor Deirdre Heenan for talking about this morning, as well as to Charles Little a little bit earlier on as well. Look, if you have been affected by any of the issues that we've been talking about this morning, please head over to the BBC Action Line. There's loads of advice and support, and hopefully something that we've said has helped you this morning. It's bbc.co.uk/actionline. It is 10:05. Before we get into the news, a bit of politics, shall we? Now, the newly elected independent MP for North Down, Alex Easton, has nominated a DUP councillor to replace him at Stormont. Peter Martin is currently a councillor in Ards and North Down. He's worked as
as a special advisor to DUP ministers at Stormont. Now, Mr Easton quit the party 3 years ago, as in the DUP, claiming it had no respect, discipline or decency, and since then has been an independent MLA at Stormont. Now, the move was confirmed last night. Until then, Mr Easton said he had been finding it difficult to find another independent to take his seat. Let's get more on this now from the former UUP Head of Communications, Alex Kane. Good morning, Alex.
Good morning, Holly.
And we also have Belfast Telegraph's Alison Morris. Good morning, Alison.
Good morning.
Now, Alex, first of all, how common is this, you know, that we've got a situation where we have an independent who's co-opting, well, a different party, so to speak?
Well, I can't actually think of one. Maybe Alison will know, but I can't actually think, because normally with parties, with the MLAs, they belong to a party, so there are very few independents anyway. And usually before they get to this stage, they already have a list. The party holds the list, or at least the party has some way, maybe it's a selection process or something like that, for making the final decision. And I think it used to be back in the day, I think you could have a list of up to six people, because you didn't know what would happen in the 4 years with MLA. And people who might have said yes to possibly, you know, taking the post might have changed jobs or gone somewhere else. So there was a process. This time with an independent, although, sorry, this is just worth saying that David McClarty, who was an Ulster Unionist MLA, after he died, his replacement, and he had nominated her himself, his replacement was actually Claire Sugden, who sat as an independent. So we've had a place where an independent has been selected before by a member of a political party. But in this particular case, this is an independent trying to find. And he's right, Alex Easton is right, there probably is no one here. There are three or four options, and I won't mention some of them, but they were talked about in the past few weeks during the election campaign.
Yeah.
And I think this is, to be honest, I think it makes sense. It makes sense in many ways, particularly since Alex Easton and Gavin Robinson today have talked about. Easton says, I, as part of pro-unionism working together, I took the seat from Alliance. And here's someone, the DUP, a party I used to belong to. And Gavin Robinson welcomes that as pro-union. Peter Martin will be pro-union. This seems to be how they're going to do it, although it's quite clear that Peter Martin will be sitting as a DUP MLA.
Alison, it won't come as a surprise, I suppose, to a lot of people. We know that he's previously been linked to the DUP, so it's the perfect fit, some might say.
Well, I'm not quite sure. I mean, as you say, Alex Easton was a member of the DUP, I think, until 2021, and he's sat as an independent since then and been elected as an independent. And those people who elected him to the Assembly elected him as an independent, not as a member of the DUP. And coming up to the recent Westminster election, we know he pulled a huge vote in North Down to take that seat off Stephen Farry. But a lot of people who I was speaking to were saying they had previously voted for Alliance because they thought maybe that the constituency needed a change, but they had decided that Alliance wasn't delivering for them. Alex Easton's a hard worker, everybody has a lot of respect for him. But one of the questions they were asking was, if I elect him, he's not going to, you know, go back to the DUP because we don't want to elect a DUP MP. It was a, you know, an independent unionist MP they were electing. So they're now getting someone who's clearly going to follow the DUP whip in the Assembly. And that's not what the voters voted for. They voted for an independent unionist. So that's the negative. I suppose the positive is he's right. There's not a, you know, there's not a whole host of candidates just sitting around waiting to be co-opted into seats. It needs to be someone capable, someone political, someone who understands the issues, someone from that constituency. And I know that Alex has been too polite there to mention, but he was at the count, as was I. And Jonathan Bell was knocking around the count around Alex Easton. And there was a lot of rumours that he might have been the co-opted person getting put into that seat into the DUP. That would have been a massive headache, you know, the return of Jonathan Bell to the Assembly. So I do think that for the DUP, it's probably the best option. If I was going to, you know, look at the positive side of it, you can see what this election did in terms of unionist unity was it managed John Seaton Alliance MP and Seaton elected.
Alison, you'll hear the music there. We are going to continue this after the news, if you don't mind. I want to take some calls on this as well to get the reaction of the DUP and the independent voters for Alex Easton straight after your BBC News. Speak then. Alex Easton's nomination for a DUP councillor to replace him at Stormont. This is because obviously MPs, he's newly elected to Westminster, Alex Easton, he can't be double jobbing now, that's out the window. So somebody else has got to take his place at Stormont, and he's gone for a DUP councillor. We're speaking to Alex Kane and the Belfast Telegraph's Alison Morris. Good morning once again. Alison, just to pick up on what you were saying there, I just want to
ask you, do you think that Alex Easton would have won in North Down had he been representing the DUP?
No, I actually don't. I think that his strength was the fact that he was standing as an independent, and he attracted all shades of unionism, because not only did he manage to unseat Stephen Farry, he also fended off stiff competition that came from the UUP and from their high-profile candidate Tim Collins. And that was because he managed to, first of all, take back all of those voters. He went to the Alliance Party. He took back numerous amount of voters. I mean, he has massive majority now. And then he also attracted all shades of unionism from people who might have been prone to maybe vote for the TUV or DUP, and also softer unionists. And then he also, which is his biggest strength, and I would say other politicians should take notice, you know, politics isn't just about selfies on social media and, you know, putting statements out to the press at opportunities. Times when you think you're maybe going to get a headline. It is about putting in the work on the ground, and that's one thing that Alex Easton does. He does the work on the ground. I mean, the numerous people of North Down who said to me, if they have a constituency issue and they go to him, it's sort of within a week, and that was his strength. So he attracted people who wouldn't even vote for anyone usually, but who voted for him because they know he's a guy who's actually, they see out and about on the streets, they see him out and around, they know he's in the constituency, they know he's doing the work. So he attracted all shades. From unionism, I suppose, it's a test case to show that unionist unity can work in the future with the right candidate. It can't work if you just randomly parachute someone in and hope that everyone will vote for them, but it can work if you pick the right candidate and if it's someone who people respect and appreciate. Alex Easton, I was trying to, he's a very unlikely politician. He's not one who actually appreciates speaking to the media. He doesn't go out of his way to speak to journalists. He prefers to talk to ordinary people. He's actually quite introverted when you do speak to him. But he was the candidate who people really resonated with, regardless of, you know, right from those lands, small unionist voters right up to the hard line. That's not something that comes along very often, and that's something that's obviously very hard to replace in his assembly seat. I do think there'll be people who voted for him who will be disappointed that he's co-opted someone from the DUP. But if I were, you know, Gavin Robinson, I would be looking at as a test case for the next election in places like East Derry and places where they can see the majority is significantly reduced. You know, is this the future, and is there scope to have those unionist unity candidates running if you can't pick the right candidate to stand? Albeit, you know, they're like hen's teeth. It's not as if, you know, there's several in every street. I mean, it's hard to find a politician who is as dedicated, I suppose, to his job as Alex Easton. There are plenty of them out there, but most of them we already know of. They're already high profile and elected. It's difficult to get those sort of up and coming young people into that role.
Well, Alex Kane, I want to read a text from John, who says, does Alex Easton really think the people in Northern Ireland are stupid? A dirty deal was done to get the seat in Stormont. Anyone could see that. What do you make of that?
Well, do you know, interestingly, right from the beginning, from the moment that the DUP back decided that they weren't going to field a candidate against Easton and made it clear that they were asking their voters to back Easton, all those rumours were going about, the parties were saying, oh, this is part of this dirty deal. This is all part of a conspiracy of unionism because the DUP are in trouble. They know they can't win it. They've one of their old members who's done very well, are standing strong as a candidate, standing strong as an independent, and he's bound to give his seat. Knowing all of that, that has been put out for 5, 6, 7 weeks, he still not only got a majority, he got the biggest majority, I think, in North Down for about 10 years. And I think that's the thing you have to bear in mind. When he first went independent, there were people telling me, oh, yes, look, he was popular, but he was popular as DUP. See, going as an independent, that's not going to work. He held his assembly seat extraordinarily well, and he picked up seats. Alison's right. He's one of these things. Alex is a very odd politician. I first got to know him back in 98, 99, and I remember thinking he's very quiet, very subdued. You know, this is a sort of guy who he was never, you know, boasting about himself or booming about all his successes and things like that. And even like within the party, he wasn't. No one ever said, you know, oh, Alex Easton's going to be a big player or MP or anything like that. He surprises a lot of people because the key to all of this, Holly, people do forget about this. It's not just about not spending your life in newspapers and social media. Mm-hmm. It's actually just someone on the ground. And I remember watching Easton about, oh, maybe 4 or 5 months ago, you know, watching him in his constituency, walking around, everybody knew who he was, every single person. And I'm old enough to remember Jim Kilfedder, who held North Down as an independent. Everybody knew Jim. Jim knew everybody. I Sylvia Herman, who used to be in my old party, the Old Students Pact, went as an independent. I walked down Bangor High Street and other places with her. Hugely popular. Everybody knew who she was. And that is Easton's success. He has 5 years as a Member of Parliament. This is a massive majority. The Labour government is not going to be an ISIS. Well, I'd be shocked if there was an election before it's 2029
yeah.
or something like that. He's a long time to bed this down. And Peter Martin, in fairness, Alison said, that wasn't a huge number of people. Picking an independent is very difficult.
Okay, much else to go for. So it's interesting. You don't really seem to think it matters what team he's playing for in this instance. Alison Morris, Alex Keane, thank you very much. Because we are going to stay on the topic of teams, because we have to talk about the football last night, don't we? Whoa, jubilation for the England fans. Pretty late on, stoppage time winner from Ollie Watkins, sending England through to the finals of the Euros.
Palmer, lovely ball to Watkins inside the area. Watkins, oh, he scored! Watkins from an impossible angle across Verbruggen and into the far bottom corner. What a strike that is from Ollie Watkins!
Oh, well, it has been a bit of a bumpy ride to the final for Gareth Southgate's side, let's be honest, with many of the fans voicing a bit of frustration over his team selection, his style of play, decisions on the pitch. But by hook or by crook, they have made it. And they're going to be facing the toughest test of the tournament on Sunday by quite some way. It is Spain. I'm here to reflect on England's win over the Netherlands last night and that love-hate relationship with the England boss. It's Mark Ogden, senior football writer at ESPN, who's in Germany covering the Euros for us. Just a reminder that that final will be taking place on Sunday. I'm going to double check where that is for you by the end of this, but I'm sure Mark will know. Mark, when's the final? What time is it on Sunday?
Hi, Holly. It's Sunday. It's in Berlin and it's 8 o'clock UK time. So,
8 o'clock. Yeah. See, better not go to penalties because honestly, it's past my bedtime and full coverage is on the BBC, of course. Right, Mark. What did you make, first of all, of the match last night? Did it go as you predicted?
Well, I did think England would win, and I thought it was probably England's best performance of the tournament. There was a period in the second half where they lost momentum, and it looked like the Dutch could, you know, get a winning goal. But I do think England, for the first time maybe this tournament, deserved to win. So they got to the final on merit, but it's a much bigger challenge against Spain. But maybe I'm getting ahead of myself here. Maybe it's time for the England fans to enjoy it, just for today at least.
Yeah, because they haven't been enjoying it. I've been chatting to a few England fans throughout this, and it's kind of... I mean, even when they were through to the semi-finals, it was almost sort of begrudging in the sense of, well, they've been a bit rubbish, really. It's not been great.
Yeah.
It's weird, isn't it?
Grim. It is, yeah. And to be honest, probably after about 60 minutes last night, the fans were getting a little bit impatient and you could sense they were beginning to turn a little bit, thinking if this isn't going as well, they're going to be complaining about lack of substitutions and lack of ambition by Southgate. But he's been making late subs and it paid off again last night. So... it's keeping everybody guessing. They keep everybody on tenterhooks. But so far, Gareth Southgate's got the big calls right.
Yeah, it was funny because as he was making those substitutions, which obviously paid off, I would think it was Ali McCoy making the comments about, look, we can't give him a hard time when he's making the substitutions whenever we give him a hard time when he doesn't. And that seems to be a theme. No matter what, Gareth Southgate gets a hard time from the media, from the fans.
I think it's because he just has this reputation for being quite cautious. And I think you see him on the touchline, he's not very expressive. And I think there are times in games when you're thinking, you know, Gareth, maybe you need to make a change now. The game's slipping away from you. He holds his nerve. And because in previous big games, semi-finals and finals, England have lost possibly because he hasn't made a change at the right time.
Mm.
But that's Gareth Southgate. He hasn't changed. And like I say, so far it's working to his favour and he's got England to a final, the first time they've ever been to a final outside of England. So it's another first for him.
And despite that, I can't help but feel that the back pages, if he doesn't win on Sunday, will be calling for his job again. Do you know what I mean?
You know, so I think, yeah. To be honest with you, I think win or lose, it's his last game on Sunday. I think he's got to the end of the line. Mm. I think he's become frustrated by the circus that goes to being the England manager. There's a lot of nonsense around it as well, which he doesn't really need to deal with, but he does because he's quite a bright, intelligent guy and he will take questions that probably don't actually relate to football management. But I think if England lose the final, I think he'll be forgiven. I think getting to a final in any major tournament is a big thing. And even England fans with the arrogance and self-confidence they sometimes have, I think even they'd accept that getting to a final is pretty much beyond expectations.
And as I said, Spain, it's going to be such a different game than they've had up until now. This is arguably the most difficult game they're going to have of the tournament. And Spain have looked almost flawless throughout. They look like the winners.
Yeah. Yes, yeah, Spain would be the best team by just a long way. They just play a different game to everybody else. The way they keep the ball, I mean, England have got to get the ball off them in the first place and then do something with it. So that's the tricky part, because England in the past, when they've had a lot of possession, haven't used it very well. So Spain will have to be on an off day for England to win, but it's possible. England has some great players and they are capable of winning, but England are definitely underdogs.
Okay, I hate doing this. I despise doing this most of the time, but I feel like... Even I feel a bit more comfortable trying to give a score prediction on this one. So go ahead, Mark Ogden. What is your score prediction for Sunday?
Fortunately for Spain, I think Spain will win 2-1.
You dropped out there a little bit. Say that again.
2-1 to Spain.
2-1 to Spain. Okay, yeah. I'm writing down all these. No, well, you don't need to apologise to me. Trust me. Mark Ogden, it's great to chat to you. I'm going to keep my powder dry until tomorrow. I'll give my score prediction then. They're shouting to me in the behind the glass here. Not a chance. Enjoy the match, Mark. I know you will.
Thanks, Holly.
Sunday evening, 8:00. And as I say, all coverage on the BBC. I am looking forward to that, I have to say. It is 10:15. We're going to be talking about age limits. And I know George Clooney was making some comments this week about his very good friend, Joe Biden. And it's kind of brought this conversation around the US presidency and whether or not there should be an age limit when it comes to being a politician, particularly when it is one of the world leaders like the President of the United States. Joe Biden and Donald Trump, a combined age of 160. Is there a question of whether you can be too old for a job like that? And there have been some serious concerns raised over Biden's mental capacity to run again as the Democrat candidate. After his TV debate with Trump, of course, that's continued into the NATO summit this week. He is due to hold another news conference today, and I'm sure all eyes will be on him and his performance. And as I mentioned, George Clooney, who's been a long-standing backer of the Democrats, is actually calling for him to stand down and allow a replacement to run. In an interview with the American television network MSNBC this week, President Biden defended his campaign.
The bottom line here is that we're not going anywhere. I am not going anywhere. I wouldn't be running if I didn't absolutely believe that I am the best candidate to beat Donald Trump in 2024. We had a Democratic nominating process where the voters spoke clearly. I won 14 right. million of those votes, et cetera. So I not only believe that from the beginning, but I wanted to reassert and demonstrate that it's true. And I'm going to be doing that all through this week and from here on.
So it does sort of raise the question of whether there should be an upper age limit on standing for office, or is that just age discrimination? Well, I spoke to student and commentator Dermot Hamill and commentator Emma Wolfe on this, and I began by asking Dermot what he made of Joe Biden's recent performance.
The first debate that they had between Joe Biden and Trump, we all got together for a watch party to watch it. And I have to say, he performed abysmally. It was quite depressing watching the most powerful man in the world kind of seemed to get mentally lost. He seemed quite fogged most of the time. He stuttered out most of the sentences he came out with. He didn't really know what he was talking about. And to be honest, he didn't really seem to know where he was. So, like, his performance, he doesn't seem mentally fit for the job.
Emma, what do you make of that assessment? I mean, to have a US president, and it has been everywhere over the last few days, clips being spread about him, his memes of his facial expressions, that sort of things. And we are talking about the President of the United States.
Yeah, well, Joe Biden is an extreme example. I think I would agree with Dermot insofar as what we've seen in recent months, I think, has been quite concerning. Without going into personal details, I think that he, you know, there does seem to be evidence of, you know, quite a sharp kind of cognitive decline, and that... with Trump a few weeks ago, was he seemed extremely confused. However, on the wider point of, you know, age limits on politicians and all of that kind of thing, we're taking Biden as an extreme example, but older politicians have a huge amount to bring to politics in terms of life experience and political experience, diplomatic experience. Many, many older people remain sharp and cognitively very, very sharp into their 70s and 80s. My father died in his early 90s and was absolutely on it you know, cognitively, right up until the end. I don't think we can generalise. I think that young people bring a lot to politics, and I think older people bring a lot to politics.
Yeah, Dermot, that's a good point. This idea that's been discussed in the last few days of perhaps there should be an age limit on who can be president, one of the world leaders, is that the way to deal with this? Is it a one-size-fits-all issue?
I think it isn't a one-size-fits-all issue. I think either, particularly in the American issue, if we look at it from there, it's not just Joe Biden. I mean, Nancy Pelosi's been around God knows how long. So many of the Senate Democrats and Republicans have been around for 50 years, for decades and decades and decades, and have been sat in these high-powerful positions and very clearly are indicating cognitive decline. I mean, we saw it with Mitch McConnell in press conferences. We've seen Nancy Pelosi not be entirely all there at times. There's been many, many Senate Democrats and Republicans and members of the House of Representatives.
And you think that's specifically to do with age?
Well, it's either that or cognitive decline. And one thing that we know is that cognitive decline is linked quite often to age. It is because these are politicians who've sat on for so long.
Well, what about stress?
Well, yes, of course, because they've been up. It is stress. But the thing is, you don't often see a 40-year-old politician who very clearly is cognitive declining at such a rate when they're in politics. But because these people who have been on for so long, I mean, if you spend 50 years in politics, it is, of course, going to have a massive effect upon your cognitive ability. That's just a fact. So whether maybe we ought to look at term limits instead and say, oh, you can serve three terms as a member of the House of Representatives, or maybe it is an age issue. Maybe we should start the cap at, say, 80, 85. I know Keir Starmer's talked about bringing in a House of Lords cap for at the age 85. I think Supreme Court justices in the UK have to stop at around 75. So maybe this kind of being a politician for life and holding on to the very last isn't really working for people.
Well, I suppose if we made it 85, Joe Biden's still well within that.
Well, he is. But I think, as pointed out, Joe Biden's the extreme. Maybe 85 is a bit early. I mean, that's for the House of Lords, and it's kind of a not very important chamber, to say the least. When it comes to the President of the USA, maybe we need to look at 75, maybe we need to look at 80, maybe we look at 70. I know that I think that you have to be at least 35 in the US Constitution to run for president, so surely by that logic it isn't entirely unfair to set an upper age limit.
And Emma, if you were to introduce an age cap, it would sort of solve the situation of anybody reaching this point, because without an age cap, you're in a situation where you've got somebody who might be in sort of cognitive decline, but you've no real reason to oust them, I suppose, for the want of a better word. So at least if they know, okay, you can't go past, say, 75, then they know when their time is over in politics.
I mean, it is a valid argument, but I just don't think we can introduce ageism in that way into our politics. I mean, look at all these 20-somethings who are now jumping on a train, heading down to Westminster in our new election. They all look incredibly young, and they're bringing fresh ideas and fresh energy, which is great, but they haven't got the life experience. They haven't got, you know, I mean, the idea that someone like Joe Biden has seen the Bay of Pigs or whatever, you know, that they've gone through huge amounts of change over the last couple of decades, over the last, 50, 60 years. And they've seen all that. I think that 70-something and 80-something brings that wisdom and that experience, and both of them are valuable. And also the interaction between younger and older politicians. I mean, it is an extreme example with Joe Biden, and I think most people agree that he's not, for whatever reason, isn't well and probably should step back. And I genuinely don't understand why his family, why his wife in particular, seemed to be almost encouraging him, anyway, in terms of the Constitution, it is tricky for him to step, you know, it isn't straightforward. Mm-hmm. So that is a specific example. But I think that introducing an upper age limit, it just sends the wrong message that we don't value age, that people just drop off the perch at 80 or 85, whereas actually it's not true. If you keep yourself fit and healthy, physically fit and healthy, it does a lot for your sort of mental capacity as well.
Yeah, Dermot, what about that? Because there is sometimes a lot to be said for having people who've been around for as long as somebody like Joe Biden has had. I mean, you can't learn that experience from a book. And it is crucial to have that mix of young and old within government.
Of course it is. You know, you need that experience. But the problem is people aren't getting into politics at 75 at 80, other than the case of Trump. But I think we can all kind of disregard Trump as kind of the archetype of what a politician should or is. I don't want to discourage older people from getting involved in politics or from being in politics. But the problem is, in the case of the US, all of these older politicians are politicians who've been around for 30, 40, 50 years. They started at 35, but usually come from some incredibly rich family, and then went on to become a blue blood Democrat, and now will probably pass their children into it. But the problem is, they're not stepping aside, and they're not being encouraged to step aside, because they've, in the case of the US, they've got massive access to money, they're in the pockets of massive lobbyists, and really and truly, money is how you get elected in the US. So, in terms of the US system, I think that they've got a massive problem that needs to address it. In the UK, I don't think we really have that problem. And in the Republic of Ireland, you have to be 21 to run for the Houses of Electors. You know, if you have to be 21, why shouldn't you stay capped at 75, 80?
Dermot, the strangest thing is that there aren't more young, you know, vibrant, energetic, inspiring younger politicians really taking the fight to Trump and Biden. You've got to look at these guys and wonder, is that the best two men that they have in such a vast country of millions of people? Is that, and I get what you're saying about the money, of course you need huge, you need billions to run for president.
Mm-hmm.
But is that the best they can offer? Is that the brightest and the best, when, yes, these men are very, pretty ancient now, and neither of them are inspiring, you know, that much kind of interest. It's amazing to me that there no one is taking the fight to them. Guys in their 30s and 40s.
And we are...
Women as well. Sorry,
that's a very
guys.
Good point. No, sorry to interrupt you, but it was just to say we focused so much on Biden, and Trump has done this very, very well. And it is obviously because, as I say, we've seen these video clips of Joe Biden doing the rounds. He's 81 years old. Trump's 78. There's only 3 years between them. And as you say, they seem to be, are these the two best men for the job? And now we're in a situation where the Democrats... They've kind of put all their eggs in this basket now with Biden at this point in the campaign, and their refusal to admit that there is any issue there could cost them an election.
I think the problem on the point of young people coming through, in the US they do seem to. I mean, people look at AOC in New York. I mean, even in Ohio, in places like that, I know there was a young man called Sam Lawrence who ran at age 19 in the last elections for their state House member, House of Representatives. I think there are young people coming through. The problem is that, to an extent, old people won't get out of the way to allow younger people to come through. People have talked about possibly Governor Gavin Newsom coming through to challenge Biden for the nomination. That will be a net positive in my view, because he's a much younger man, he's much more cognitive.
Emma, I suppose, and you said earlier with the representation of both women, but to encourage younger people to come through, maybe if there was an age cap, it would prevent this from happening.
I don't think that the reason young people aren't going into politics, if they're not, and a lot of people are, but I don't think it's to do with upper age limits or anything like that. I think, you know, it's a very, very different system in America. You need huge amounts of money, and there are these kind of dynasties as well, as Dermot points out. So I think it's about getting people inspired and excited. And when you see an election like we've just had in the UK, and record low turnout, I mean, Holly, the second lowest ever turnout, and the first lowest ever turnout was at the end of the First World War, 1918. So when people are that disinterested or disconnected or uninspired by politics and by our politicians, and for whatever reason, by the two choices on offer, because Sunak and Starmer were not inspiring people. There was another leader who was inspiring people, but as we know, our system is so broken that did not translate into seats. Or many seats. But yeah, I think people need to be, you know, people will go into politics if they feel inspired and they want to take up arms and go and sort of make a difference to their country.
With that in mind, if we're not inspiring people, and from what we know particularly of the US system and the role really that the president plays and the amount of people who are behind him making all the moves and decisions, does it matter, Dermot?
I think it does matter. I think having politicians inspire... I mean, like, look at Joe Biden. He's the president of the United States in America. He's meant to be essentially the most inspiring, most important man in the world. And when you look at him, you kind of see a bit of a dull grey blank that kind of was going to is going to misspeak every so often and maybe say something out of turn and out of pocket. You might just hope he'll say something from his views in the 60s just for a headline. I think it does matter. It matters that we get young people in, and it matters that we inspire young people to care about politics. People are apathetic at politics at best. I mean, whenever I was trying to convince people to go out and vote for this election in the UK, people were apathetic. People didn't care. And to be honest, apathy was the best we could hope for. That was a good day. Like, people really, really are sick of politics these days. People are really sick of looking at the US, looking at our leaders in the UK and going, what is there for people? What is there for me to look at? What is there for me to say? That attracts me. That gets me interested. That gets me inspired. There's very little.
Well, we better stop talking about it then. We've lost all our interest. Dermot Hamill and Emma Wolfe, thank you so much for discussing this with me today. A really interesting conversation that. Thank you all for being on the show today. All of our guests, our calls and our texts. Thanks to our brilliant listeners, as always, for your comments on today's stories. If you do want to drop us a little message ahead of tomorrow's show, please do so. It's just nolan@bbc.co.uk. You'll find us all across the social medias, X or Twitter, whatever you call it these days. Tomorrow's my last day in for Stephen. Ooh, I wonder what you'll have in store for me. I will see you at 9 o'clock. Mr. Connor Phillips is next.
The biggest show in the country. Listen again on BBC Sounds. Tweet at Stephen Nolan.
What are the most memorable travel adventures? Those where we open our eyes and our minds to new experiences. It's all to see here in Azerbaijan. New flavors, a new appreciation of ancient history, of natural beauty and of rich contrasts. This is a world of culture, cuisine, wellness and adventure, all yours for the taking. Thought you knew Azerbaijan? Take another look. To plan your Azerbaijan adventure, visit azerbaijan.travel.
Hi, wir sind Kathi und Christina und wir machen den Lifestyle of Longevity Podcast, den meistgehörten Podcast in Deutschland zum Thema Langlebigkeit.
Du hast einen super beschäftigten Alltag und weißt gar nicht, wie du die Zeit für gesunde Routinen finden sollst? Keine Sorge, wir zeigen dir, wie du mit kleinen Hacks nicht nur idealerweise 110 wirst, sondern auch im Hier und Jetzt viel mehr Energie hast.
Wenn du zum Beispiel wissen möchtest, wie wir dafür unsere Morgenroutinen angepasst haben, höre doch mal in Folge 18 rein. Ansonsten gibt es jeden Donnerstag eine neue Folge des Lifestyle of Longevity Podcasts.
Wir freuen uns, wenn ihr zuhört.